Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect welcomes Alex Schadenberg, Executive Director for 10 years of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Okay. We're on the show. We've been talking for a couple of weeks about the issues with unintended or death without consent of infants at Canadian hospitals, and you wanted to help us clarify what this means in terms of autonomy and choice.
Well, what we're talking about in the last two cases, you were talking about children who are born with disabilities and the attitudes towards them and the outcomes of how they were treated at these children's hospitals. And when we look at what's happening, that's really got a lot to do with this concept of futile care theory. You know, futile care theory comes from the original idea around, certain treatments don't have very many benefits anymore, so they've become futile, so should we continue with that?
Oh, really?
And that's where that sort of idea came from. But then what happened is the bioethics movement started to rearrange and look at that in a different way. And what it was is they started deciding, not only who should receive care for what reason, but at a certain point, they started looking at certain patients as futile. So if you have
new.
Well, that's something that came out in the last 20 years that a patient, rather than a treatment being futile. So you can understand a certain treatment could be futile. You can understand that there's a certain point where we're not going to continue to provide a treatment for cancer or other conditions because the person isn't going to get better.
Right.
And that the best thing to do is just to provide comfort care and continue in that sort of mode.
Right.
But the new sort of idea is that the patient becomes futile, and it's not overt necessarily either that they come this way. They'll look at the situation and say, oh, this child or this person has a significant disability or their health condition has gotten worse. But you see, it extends further than just the treatment. It extends to basic care, because in this case of a basic care situation, it might be said that since the patient is futile, why would we even then provide food and fluids? Why do we even then provide medical testing and things like that, because the fact is that this child is supposedly going to die anyway, or this person is dying anyway.
Right.
Why would we do anything, even if it's a benefit for that person, other than, of course, comfort care, which is considered to be something that we always provide. So this is where some of this has gone. So patients have become futile, and this really affects children, because children born with disabilities then are often looked at as having a certain level of futility. They will say, well, these children will cost an awful lot of money in order to recover, and to what level will they ever recover?
Is that new, the entrance of cost-benefit into this in terms of money? I mean, I could see that futile care would deal with cost-benefit in terms of effort and effect, but now it seems to me expense.
Well, I think money was always in the back of some people's minds, but the fact is that in the past, the attitude was always to do as much as we can at all times. So if it was possible to do something to help you, the idea was to do that. Now, I'm not sure if that was always the best idea either, but at the same time, you didn't run into these situations where a child was judged at such a young age. I'll give you an example. You know, you could be born with spina bifida.
Right.
And the reason I mention spina bifida is because in the Netherlands, where they have the Groningen Protocol, that's the protocol they followed to euthanize newborn babies. It was the issue of, it was the whole condition of spina bifida that they used in order to, decide to develop this Groningen Protocol. And it was all based on a court decision. It It was the Prins case in I believe it was 1997, where the Supreme Court of the Netherlands told the doctor, his name was Prins, that he had done wrong for euthanizing the baby.
But when was this?
It was 1997, I believe, that the case was went to the Supreme Court in the Netherlands.
All right.
And they had said they had agreed that he had done wrong, but at the same time they said, but the baby was suffering, so it's okay.
Oh.
And so therefore that opened the door to the euthanizing of children with spina bifida.
Oh.
So what happened with the Groningen protocols, in the Netherlands euthanasia had been legal all along, but it was done by the courts.
Okay.
So about 1985 that began by the courts, and before then there was different court decisions which opened it up further and further, and in 1985 there was this set of principles that the Supreme Court of the Netherlands set down. So it was illegal by law, but it was allowed by the court.
Okay.
Similar to certain things that have happened in Canada, too.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, in 2002, when the Dutch government then officially legalized euthanasia, so they actually changed the law to recognize the court decisions, what they did is they said that if you're under 12, you couldn't be euthanized.
You could not.
You could not. So this created a problem in the Netherlands because they had already been euthanizing newborns.
Right.
So what do you do with these newborns that are born with certain medical conditions who they've already been injecting them,
mm-hmm.
and now the law says they're under 12, we can't inject them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they developed this Groningen protocol. But it was all around the issue of spina bifida, and they used the example of the Prins court decision and 22 cases of euthanasia of children with spina bifida between 1997 and 2005 to develop the Groningen protocol. So I'll get back to it. The point of it is that these are decisions not made because the child might not do well.
Right.
The child might do well. It's based on the fact that if the child does well, this child's going to be a great expense.
Oh, no.
And even if this child doesn't do well, this child will be a great expense. And isn't it more compassionate just to end it now? You know, so there's certain lives that are not worth living.
Or not worth paying for to live.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely connected to it, because obviously when we're looking at cases of spina bifida, you can always do something for those children.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, most of them do very well today,
mm-hmm.
especially the ones that are properly treated, receive proper surgery and rehabilitative care. Most of them actually today do very well.
Yeah.
And, graduating from university is not something that you should say is impossible for a child with spina bifida. In fact, just the other day I was talking to a girl who I know who lives up in... Thunder Bay, and she was at a meeting that I was at, and she's in a wheelchair. She was born with spina bifida, and she's graduated from university.
Mm-hmm.
So it's it can be a cognitive disability for some, but not for all.
Okay. Right? What normally describes spina bifida, the range of?
Well, it would vary, but the fact of it is that it's a painful condition if you don't do the surgery. They have to close the back up, because what it is you have the nerve endings exposed. The baby's born with an opening, right,
no.
in the back.
No.
And you have this sort of opening with the exposure of all the nerves and everything. If you don't do anything, obviously the child will die of a condition because of the there'll be infection, there'll be all these other problems. So they have to do something, as I say in the Netherlands, they could do something else. They'll inject them.
Okay.
The fact is that there's other conditions they do that for, too, but that was the prime case I'm referring to, right? And I think that's clearly a case of eugenic euthanasia.
Yeah.
Because it's not about the fact that a child is unlikely to do well, because most of them do well. It's the fact that they've decided that these children are better off dead than living. And if you think about that, sadly, that also brings us back to... 1920, a book written in Germany by two German physicians named Binding and Hawk. And they wrote a book called The Destruction of Life Not Worth Living, right?
Really?
Yeah, and that was the book that actually led to the whole German euthanasia program.
Wow.
Because it was that book that became accepted in German medicine as being an acceptable way of looking at these issues.
Who were the authors again? They were Hawk and...
Binding and Hawk.
Yeah. Binding and Hawk, okay.
That was a very famous book. It became something that was very influential in German society, and especially in the medical community, and it became accepted as an acceptable way to act, that when there are certain conditions that that person is now deemed that their life was not worth living, that it's better to end their life by euthanasia. Now, of course, that was not about choice, right? It's not about autonomy. It's not about choice. It's about choosing when a life is worth living or not worth living.
It also leads to a kind of social hierarchy, right? I mean, if you have anything abnormal about you, immediately you don't belong to that select group of people who are to go forward with the human race in perfect form.
Right, that's exactly it. But the fact is it's a direct threat to certain people's lives because you're considered to have a certain level of life in order to be worthy of life. Well, that's a pretty scary thing to say in society that certain people's lives are worth living and others are not. So then the question is it's not only about how do we care for people with disabilities or how do we provide services and opportunities for people with disabilities. The question is whether or not we actually recognize that they have a right to live.
Yeah.
That's pretty...
How did this survive World War II? This doctrine?
Well, it didn't at first, actually.
Really?
The whole euthanasia... See, we like to think of the euthanasia movement as being something that's modern in North America. In fact, it's not.
Right.
The whole eugenics movement in the United States and Canada was very prominent in the 1920s and 30s. And in Canada, there was a major successful eugenic program that led to the sterilization of many, many people with disabilities in several provinces in Canada. And you hear about that in the U.S. too, but the same eugenics movement was involved with attempting to legalize euthanasia in the 1930s already.
Oh.
They were not successful then, but they were very, very influential, and they had significant money behind them.
What defeated them in the 30s?
Well, I guess people weren't... it was a different society then, but they didn't have enough support. But they did have money. It was funny enough, they had a lot of financial support, and they had very big campaigns.
Mm.
And we don't think about it in history now because it's been so long ago. But what happened is, of course, the whole thing went underground after the Second World War because of the news that came out what happened in Germany.
Right.
The whole concept of eugenics and euthanasia became, out of vogue.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't talk that way when you've just witnessed the outcome of such ideas.
Yeah.
But it didn't disappear, though.
Okay.
It didn't disappear at all. And then, of course, now it's reemerged because... there's new leadership and new ideas. Now it's sold to us around choice and autonomy.
Yeah.
And at that time it was sold to us as the need for a pure race and the ending of suffering of lives of people who were feeble-minded and considered idiots.
Yeah, I remember reading with astonishment that the guideline, when the stocks of antivirals were low and we were anticipating a flu pandemic, the guidelines set up for who was worthy of receiving antivirals on the front line and specifically excluded people of limited cognitive ability. Now they say the guidelines are no longer necessary because we have the stocks of antivirals, but are those values no longer predominant? I'm not so sure.
You know, it's very hard to say why people make decisions, but a lot of it comes down to really a financial consideration or simply a decision that some people's lives are more valuable than others. Now, I have a hard time thinking that way, but I do agree that there are some sort of limitations that are necessary within society until we have the ability to provide for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use the example, once again, I said it used to be considered that certain medical treatments had to be rationalized because we didn't have it for everybody.
Yeah.
So how do you make the decision when you only have so many kidney dialysis machines? How do you make the decision who gets kidney dialysis and who doesn't?
Yeah.
Until you have enough medical technology that's been purchased in place, somebody has to make those decisions. So I understand that, but at the same time, this is sort of a different thing. It's gone the other direction. Now, what we see also, you see, it's more covert now, too, because the fact is that we don't like to say to somebody, oh, well, it's better to end your life.
Yeah.
You know, so the case of these babies at, these children's hospitals, you have these situations where instead of giving the full information to a parent because they think the parent might be too stupid,
yeah,
the parent might actually decide they might actually want to try and save the life of their child, so they hide the truth from the parent and deny them an opportunity to actually make the medical decision because they might be too stupid to make the right decision or the wrong decision. And that is paternalism to the extreme, for the first place. But secondly, it's because they really do think that we are too dumb to know better. And on top of it, they think that certain lives are not worth living. And wouldn't it be a waste of resources if you're actually to try and save that child's life? Yeah. Now, if I came down and said that to them, they'd say, oh, no way, no way.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the question is, so then how did you make those medical decisions then?
Yeah.
Why did you do that? Why did you make those medical decisions? Oh, we did it based on the best interest of the child. What do you mean? That child's dead.
Yeah.
You know, that child might have had a good chance of survival. The parents are happy with that child. Is it because you thought the society was better off without that child? You know, these questions are things we need to ask, you know.
Now we'll take a short musical break. This is Patman and Stark on Kenny Wayne Shepherd's album, 10 Days Out. And this song, The Prison Blues, is it stretching a metaphor too far to imagine these children imprisoned in values that they wouldn't share?
Every morning by the break of day, picking Shelba in my hand. True to the woods, I'm a natural man. on to some.
Oh, yeah.
When will I ever make it back home?
You'll make it. They know. They gonna let you know when you do your time. They tell you, you can go home now. That's right.
Well, will I ever make it back home?
You've been listening to the Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, Alex Schadenberg, talk about the reemergence after World War II of eugenics and persuading people, especially the frail elderly, the parents of vulnerable infants and people with disabilities, that it's better not to live, but to die.
But what do we do when it goes this way? Well, the fact is it's covert, and most parents actually don't fight back, and most parents are too distraught by what happened that they don't usually ask the questions to find out the reality. So if you have very few parents who do, some of them are even considered crazy for wanting to know the answers.
Well, it's kind of odd that Jason Wallace's criminal background came out during his fight for his daughter's life, Kaylee. And you begin to wonder where the leak was, where the source was, what the purpose was, and why the timing was what it was.
Well, obviously, yeah. In this case, it was to discredit
Jason Wallace.
Yeah. Without a question. And the fact is that Joubert syndrome was not a terminal condition.
Right.
And once you make that statement very clear that this is not a terminal condition, why is this child being treated like it has a terminal condition? Then you have to start really questioning how this all came to be. Now, of course, I have no information as to the inside scoop on why those decisions were being made in the way they were. It's just a big question in my head.
Yeah.
Now, when we look at the further how it goes, it's even beyond. Like, we'd like to talk about children because, of course, children can't make decisions for themselves, and these decisions are being made paternalistically for parents. And you're talking about parents in a vulnerable situation, so obviously they would rarely fight back. But what about the frail elderly who become in a situation where they can't respond effectively for themselves anymore either?
I had a mother die 3 years ago, and whether it was her choice or not, we'll never know, but she was slow-coded by the doctors. She seemed to be beginning recovery well on antibiotics, but she had an argument with a nurse. And we were with her around the clock. There was a four-hour gap in our attendance on her. And when the four-hour gap ended and one of us came into her room, she had died. And we assume she took her own life. But we don't understand why she was permitted to.
Yeah, it's difficult to know because you'll never find out.
No.
The fact is that... people become, they end up in a very vulnerable situation here, and how do we protect them? That's the question I always ask. So the attitude in society is that we respect our elders, and when they get into these medical situations, though, do we actually recognize that we should be helping them or not be helping them? When it comes down to it, yes, we understand that a terminally ill person who is terminally ill and who is nearing death mm-hmm. should be cared for comfortably mm-hmm. and allowed to die a natural death in a nice, comfortable manner.
Yeah.
But I'm not talking about those people now. I'm talking about other people.
Yeah.
And the fact is that these people aren't making decisions for themselves. It's not about choice, and it's not about autonomy. Now, when we come down to medical decisions, now what happens if you actually legalize euthanasia and assisted suicide now?
What happens, it appears to me, first off, is that any shortening of life is now deemed a terminal condition. So if instead of living another 10 or 20 years, your prognosis with whatever illness you have is another 3 or 4 years, you're regarded as terminal. But 3 or 4 years of life is 3 or 4 years of life.
Well, it's all different between how people would interpret these things. But the fact is that if you have a certain medical condition, there is going to be a question whether or not you should receive basic medical care. And I'm not talking about comfort care. I'm talking about basic medical care.
Yeah.
Basic things which would actually help you recover. And we're not even talking about extraordinary means now, right? And when I look at these questions, I would say, okay, well, then let's eliminate the extraordinary means, the very expensive type of technology from the equation,
yeah.
and now discuss you know, why are we not providing certain types of basic care? And I'm not saying every physician doesn't do this or every health care institution is not doing this, but many are not doing it. Many have now sort of imposing a new policy on this stuff. And that's because they deem certain lives that at a certain point it's not worth it anymore.
Yeah, come on, your ticket's up, you know, give it up. Don't keep fighting this futile fight, you know.
But if you go into it then further about, you know, then if you do legalize euthanasia-assisted suicide as a nation, and once these attitudes have already become pervasive in society, then why would you then continue, as you would say, not providing that basic care to allow them to die quicker when it's just very quick and, I guess, more dignified to give them an injection? Why would you dehydrate someone to death and not provide them fluids in order for them to die within 2 weeks,
right, if
you can, which is obviously not a very compassionate way to die, if you can just inject them? And then people say, oh, that won't happen. Well, no, that doesn't happen immediately. I agree. It takes a little while for things, attitudes to adjust in society.
Well,
but it will happen.
One of my guests identified records showing a lethal dose of fentanyl being withdrawn for the child. And after the child died, the dose was not noted returned, was not noted lost, and the dose was withdrawn in the child's name.
Right, and in that case, the only defense they have is that they say, oh, it wasn't used, but it was destroyed. Well, what do you mean? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Do we just dump fentanyl down the drain every day?
Yeah.
And if we did, you'd be pretty careful about it because, as you know, if it were tied to something you did which was unethical, there would be a lot of concerns. So if you did this enough, people would start saying, well, where did that fentanyl actually go?
Yeah.
You know,
are we drinking it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so, you know, you get down to these things. Well, I'm going to go further, and I'll say to you, okay, for instance, in Oregon, the state of Oregon legalized assisted suicide.
Yes.
And it's been legal since 1998.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, well, you know, that's fine. It's people's choice. Well, you know, you have to look at the law and look further at it and say, well, what do you mean by the people's choice? How the law works is that you request assisted suicide, and your doctor determines whether or not you're competent to request it and that sort of thing, or whether or not you're terminally ill, has to get a second doctor to approve, and then you receive your prescription, and then you can take it when you want. And that seems, oh, well, that's about choice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, there's been quite a few physicians who have said no to their patients that they were either A, too depressed, or B, they did not qualify because A, they weren't terminally ill, or B, they weren't in pain and suffering, or they weren't nearly in a situation where they should be considering assisted suicide.
So these were patients or doctors who said no?
Doctors saying no.
Right.
And then what happens is that the family will just find a way to refer them to the Compassion and Choices Group.
Oh.
In Oregon, the Compassion and Choices Group is the political lobby group which worked to legalize assisted suicide. It's the same group that worked politically to successfully legalize assisted suicide in Washington State. They are the euthanasia lobby group.
Uh-huh.
But they also run the assisted suicide law in Oregon.
Right.
Because last year, of the 60 deaths by assisted suicide, 53 of them were facilitated by Compassion and Choices.
I see.
So what you have is a situation where the doctors say no to somebody, and then a daughter or a husband will urge them to contact Compassion and Choices, and then they get their prescription anyway because they go to a physician who says, yes, because the physician supports the idea and is big on the idea. So instead of being more careful and thinking, well, I know this is legal, but I don't really think you qualify, they think it's your basic right to have this, and then you get it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you look at it, you have the doctor shopping. So the first thing is the protections aren't in place because you have doctor shopping. Well, the second thing is once you get your prescription, there is no witness that's needed to be there at the death.
Oh.
So the question is, are these people taking this willingly?
Because
I already told you about the doctor shopping. Or is it being given to them?
Yeah.
There's no way of proving.
Yeah.
There's no way of proving. Now, they do say that in the 53 out of the 60 cases which were last year, which were facilitated by Compassion and Choices, almost in every one of those 53 cases, the Compassion and Choices volunteer was present at the death. But that doesn't make me feel too secure either, because that's
right.
The euthanasia lobby present at the death, who organized and made sure that the death could take place, and who are just witnessing it to make sure it's taken care of.
You mentioned this has become legal in Oregon. I understand from Margaret Doerr that it's also a battle in Washington State.
Yeah, Washington State, it just became legal.
Okay.
There was a plebiscite or a vote on it in the last election.
Right.
And it did pass in Washington State, and so it officially came into place in March of this year.
Now, Margaret submitted a brief, an amicus brief, to the Montana Supreme Court. Is it now an issue in Montana as well?
Yeah, what happened in Montana is Judge Dorothy McCarter decided to impose assisted suicide upon the state of Montana. She decided on her own to make it legal in Montana without any safeguards whatsoever. So when I'm talking to you about the fact that in Oregon, it's really to talk about autonomy and choice is really a lie. The fact is, in Montana, there's no use even talking about these concepts of autonomy and choice because there are no restrictions to it. Dorothy McCarter just said it was a right to every citizen of Montana to have assisted suicide. It's one of those rights like other rights, and she interpreted it. She wrote it into the Constitution
of the state
by her own decision.
Okay.
And so right now it has been challenged by the Attorney General of Montana, and that's why Margaret Doerr wrote an amicus brief to speak about the situation and how really this is all about a lie and a misconception. And what Dorothy McCarter did is she used the stats from Oregon to suggest that, oh, well, you know, things aren't so bad in Oregon. We should have the same, you know, you have the right to die here, and there isn't really any concern for the vulnerable because look at Oregon, it's not so bad.
Right.
Well, it all depends on how you look at the numbers, first of all, but secondly, since when did it become the position of a judge to impose death, you know, upon its citizens?
Yeah.
I find this very concerning.
Well, I think it was Frank Lloyd Wright, although it may have been Louis Sullivan, who said that an architect can only hope that ivy grows, and a doctor gets to bury their mistakes. And that's certainly true when you look for people opposing these statutes. The people who would probably most vociferously oppose them aren't here anymore.
No, and if you look at it further, the people with disabilities have been the strongest opposition to euthanasia and assisted suicide. When you start looking at these statutes and look at these laws clearly and understand the history, it starts making an awful lot of sense. Because if you recognize yourself as someone who defends the rights of people with disabilities, you would also have to say that euthanasia and assisted suicide is a direct threat to the lives of people with disabilities and other vulnerable people in society. The other comeback always is, well, in Oregon, it tends to be white, educated, wealthy people who choose assisted suicide in Oregon.
Right.
They would say choose. But the fact is that just because you're white, wealthy, and educated does not mean you're not vulnerable. And in fact, Margaret Doerr would explain to you that, and she's, as you might have said to people before, your audience, where she's actually an expert in the whole area of elder abuse.
Yeah.
That's her area of law. And she would tell you very clearly it's the people who have money who've got far more to be concerned about in the area of elder abuse.
Yeah.
Because if you happen to have not been the nicest mother to your children, or if you happen to have a lot of money and your nieces and nephews know that some of it's coming their way and they didn't like you that much anyway, or they wanted to get their hands on it, well, guess what? It may seem ridiculous, but the fact is it's enough to push you over the edge, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, especially if there doesn't seem to be any comeback.
But if we go further to it, it seems it's sold as this great right and this great freedom. Well, really, it's the right to die has never been actually a freedom, and it's never been about autonomy. It's about imposing death upon people in the most vulnerable time of their life.
Yeah.
It's about creating fear and having people suggest they're going to suffer so greatly that they're better off to die before they suffer. Because it's not about people dying when they're suffering. That's the other funny thing about it. When you look at all the stats, you realize, in fact, it's not people who are suffering who tend to choose or who are having euthanasia or assisted suicide imposed upon them. It's the people who are in fear of suffering that go ahead and have this lethal dose injected into them or they take it themselves. So it's really about how we've abandoned people, and it's really about how we've convinced them that it's better to die now than to be in fear.
We'll take a short musical break with John D. Holman on Kenny Wayne Shepherd's Guitar Disc, 10 Days Out. Chapel Hill Boogie.
Chapel Hill, Chapel Hill's on the ball. When you go to Chapel Hill, you gotta drink alcohol. Do the boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie. What a boogie all night long. I was standing on a corner with a glass in my hand. She come by and say, "Who? That's my man." Do do. Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, where the boogie all night long. Boogie why now? Chicken, she thought it was a duck.
Yeah,
and put it on the table with his legs sticking up. Do the Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, boogie woogie all night long.
The other little chickens, they was all staying around. They all were down the boogie until the sun went down. Do the boogie. Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, where the boogie woogie all night long. Yeah, boogie.
Chicken day was all staying around, all done a boogie till the sun went down. Do the boogie, Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, where the boogie all night long. Well, you go to Chapel Hill, Chapel Hill is a ball. You go to Chapel Hill, get a drink of alcohol. Do the Chapel Hill boogie.
I believe I need a drink now.
Do the Chapel Hill boogie. Do the Chapel Hill boogie. Boogie woogie all night long.
Yeah.
Go to Tin Top. Tin Top was right. When you go to Tin Top, they start a fuss and fight. Do the Chapel Hill boogie. The Chapel Hill boogie, the Chapel Hill boogie, what a boogie all night long. Play it a while. Look at sis, she's standing in the backyard doing something like this. Do the boogie, Chapel Hill boogie, do the Chapel Hill boogie, where the boogie all night long. Thank you.
together now.
Listening to the executive director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, Alex Schadenberg, talk about the reemergence after World War II of eugenics and persuading people, especially the frail elderly, the parents of vulnerable infants and people with disabilities, that it's better not to live, but to die.
I understand we have a private members bill happening in Ottawa. Too, about
Francine Lalonde, the Bloc Québécois member she's one of the Bloc Québécois members of Parliament. This is her third attempt to legalize euthanasia, and it's a suicide in Canada. So her goal is to amend Section 222, which is on homicide, and Section 241 of the Criminal Code, which is assisted suicide.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, you would not commit homicide if you did it for the reasons of her bill, and you would not commit assisted suicide if you did it for the reasons of her bill,
mm-hmm.
That are stated in her bill. Now, what are the reasons? First of all, you're going to notice that the media is going to tell you it's all about terminal illness.
Right.
She does not define it as terminal illness.
Right.
She says it's for people who are experiencing physical or mental pain.
Right.
Or terminally ill.
Oh.
So it's not about being terminally ill and experiencing physical and mental pain, which might be a very serious reason that most people would look at seriously. It's about if you are experiencing physical and mental pain or if you're terminally ill. So you could be someone who experiences chronic pain. And there's many people who go through chronic pain for many years, and it's a terrible situation. We should be doing far more for these people. But I don't think we should be imposing death on them.
No.
I just don't think that's an answer to chronic pain sufferers.
I have a 90-some-odd-year-old aunt who would agree with you.
Further to that, people suffer from chronic mental pain. They go through long bouts of depression for very many people in everywhere. You have a situation where a lot of people have, mental imbalances or they have imbalances within their hormonal system or whatever, the chemicals in their brain. And they go through long bouts of depression, and that is chronic. And the fact is that sometimes the medication is working well, and sometimes it's not.
Right.
But I don't think that that's a reason for imposing death upon them.
No.
And even if you're terminally ill, why should we be imposing death upon people who are terminally ill? We should be providing good care for them. But, if we say that, today if you're terminally ill, you should have euthanasia and assisted suicide offered to you, well, then consider my stepfather who died. He had cancer in his liver, and he was told he had 6 months to live. So somebody would say, well, that's a reasonable situation. Liver cancer isn't the nicest situation in general.
Yeah.
But he ended up living almost 2.5 years. He had high quality of life, and he was receiving effective pain control. He was not suffering. And it gave my mother and him a fair amount of time where they could spend together. And actually, I think it was very good. I shouldn't say this, but I think it was very good for my mother because she had the opportunity to actually care for somebody who absolutely needed that care, and it was a way of expressing love.
Yeah.
Some would say, well, that's a high and mighty sort of thing to say, but I'd say, well, no, that's very human, actually.
Yeah.
It's very human.
Yeah. Do you think that if there were some distance put between the money raised for routine medical care and the cost of extreme care, that would help the issue at all, that would help remove some of this expedience around cost and benefit?
No, I think it's all a mathematical lie, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
They say that the majority of healthcare dollars are spent on people in the last 6 months of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so they say, if we can just somehow
shorten everybody's life by 6 months.
Well, that's part of it in that sense. But if we can certainly find the areas where we can say that it's not worth spending the money, that we will save millions and millions and millions of dollars. But the fact is when you actually look at end-of-life care, because you can't just suddenly say, well, someone has this condition, we're going to give up on them.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen that way, and if it shouldn't happen that way, because that would mean we would have futile care to the extreme. We'd have people who are abandoned everywhere.
Yep.
And the other thing is, how many people who have been determined to have 6 months left of life live 5 and 6 and 10 years?
Yeah.
Because, in fact, the prognosis was somewhat accurate. It just wasn't completely accurate.
Yeah.
So, you know, you go further to it, that, you know, I think that we couldn't accept that situation, nor should we ever consider accepting it. But further to that, the actual cost of end-of-life care, so now when we've determined that this person is now entering a dying phase.
Yeah.
And you can identify that. They start experiencing, organ failure and body breakdowns. And
yeah.
It's a natural thing in the human condition that people start experiencing these situations. But when you consider the actual cost of caring for people when it's done effectively, it's not that much money compared to other forms of care. We don't need to do extraordinary medical treatment. We don't need to do all these things. We do need to provide good care for people. And that is not overly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we'd be saving billions and billions of dollars by coming down with euthanasia as a way to find the answer. I think what we would be doing, though, is we'd be directly and intentionally causing the death of many people who would be better off receiving good care than death.
Is it possible we could decouple the costs of extreme care or end-of-life care from other medical costs so that they're not under the same scrutiny as, look, a flu vaccination costs us $25, you know, but this person's costing us $25,000, we can't do this. Can we separate them?
You know where the big costs come in?
Where?
There's certain things that are very, 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 very expensive. One of them, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't ever do this, but one of them is organ donation.
Oh, it's expensive.
When you start looking at the cost in our medical system per action, like per medical treatment for a person, organ donation is very, very, very expensive.
Mm.
And so, you know, some of these things we have to look at and say, okay, I'm not saying we shouldn't do organ donation, but as a society, maybe we have to relook at what we're doing. And
okay.
I'll give you a further example to that. You know, you might understand a little bit about adult stem cell research.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the embryonic stem cell research, which creates all kinds of problems,
mm-hmm.
both ethically and medically. But the adult stem cell research is coming up with all these great new results, wonderful medical advances.
Yeah, they're taking skin cells and turning them into stem cells.
Yeah, I think that we should be doing a far more research into adult stem cell research, because I think that would become, in the end, certain types of organ donation would become not necessary anymore.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why organ donation is so expensive. Well, one of the reasons is because it's lifetime care. Because you have to take anti-rejection drugs the rest of your life. There's all kinds of medical issues related to them. So once again, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be helping certain people by organ donation. I am suggesting, though, that there might be a better way of handling this in the near future, and we should be putting our resources there. And that's a very expensive type of care.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, we're not in any way saying that certain types of extraordinary medical treatment should be denied people who can benefit from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying there's better things that we should be looking at. I don't want in any way suggest that we should be denying people beneficial treatments
mm-hmm.
that will provide good life results for them.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely don't believe we should be saying that to people with disabilities, because they have a disability, you should not be receiving extraordinary medical treatment that will provide great benefit to you. Absolutely not. But I do think we have to look at this medical care issue differently in the 21st century and how we provide it and where we provide our research.
I appreciate very much the time you spent with me. We've spent quite some time discussing it, Alex. Is there anything else that you personally would like to say that we haven't said?
Yeah,
are there any events?
About Francine Lalonde, and I wanted to get further to it.
Okay.
Because it's once again something it's going to be sold to us that this is about autonomy and
yep.
choice. But you know, the most insidious thing about this bill of hers is how she defines competence.
Okay.
And she defines competence as one who appears to be lucid.
Oh, dear.
And I've never, ever, ever, ever... Like, in Canada, we have 10 provinces, 3 territories. And in those 10 provinces, each province has its own legislation dealing with competency in relation to medical care.
Right.
None of them define competency as appearing to be lucid.
No.
They all have definitions that actually attempt to try and determine that you're competent.
Yeah.
So the fact is that she is saying that you can have... be given this lethal dose if you appear
not to be lucid.
Well, let me tell you, I have children here.
Yeah, that's the flip side of it, isn't it? If you appear not to be lucid, that's it for you.
What does it mean to appear to be lucid? Especially since she's already put in the bill that you can have euthanasia for mental pain issues.
Yeah.
Chronic mental situations. And these are people who can be treated, and at the same time, we know that they're always going to have these chronic problems. We understand that. But now they only have to appear to be lucid. This is ridiculous. But so I go one step further, and I say, well, what does it mean to appear to be lucid? So as I say, I have children at home, and when I wake up in the morning, I often appear to be lucid. That doesn't mean I'm actually lucid. What does it mean to appear to be lucid? So I come down to it, and I say, well, what it actually means is that she wants to make sure that even people who are not necessarily completely competent but have some level of competency would also be offered her great right to die, as she wants everybody to have this great freedom. But it's not about competency now, is it? It's about providing death to people, and it's about the rules for creating that death opportunity. So really, when we look at this bill that Lalonde has presented, or if we look at all the statutes it has in it, you really have to realize it's not about actually competency. It's not about autonomy. It's not about a free choice. Because when you look at it, it's not about those things, really. It's about the doctor's procedure that he must follow in order for him or her, physician, to determine whether or not they can kill you.
Yeah.
It's really about giving the right to another person, a medical practitioner, as it's defined in that bill, to cause your death.
Yeah.
It's not about your freedom. It's not about your choice. It's not about your competency. It's not about your right to die. It's about somebody else having the right to directly and intentionally cause your death. And I don't think society should ever be going there.
How do we? How does someone who's interested in this issue follow up on this bill?
Well, they can come to our website, and or they can Google us, Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. That's the easiest way to find the website.
Okay.
You Google Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, and boom, it pops right up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take a look at our information, and sometime later on tomorrow there'll be a full assessment of the bill online, as well as you can read up further. You can Google International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. That's the big group in the U.S. and they have all the information there. You can follow and read about it, and what you'll learn is you'll learn that this is all about lies. It's about ideas that in the end result in the direct and intentional killing of people.
And it's
a direct threat to the most vulnerable, because these are the people who society already deems as having lives that are not necessarily worth living.
Again, Alex, I thank you very much for your time and your insight.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll talk to you again.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, Alex Schadenberg, talk about the reemergence after World War II of eugenics and persuading people, especially the frail elderly, the parents of vulnerable infants, and people with disabilities, that it's better not to live, but to die. And now for Omar and the Howlers to take us out with his appropriately titled Bamboozled.
I'm in a hood. nickels in a shoeshine can. I've been a hoodwinker. I've been bamboozled. I've been left for dead. I've been plagued by refusal. Swindling, straight and narrow, walk a chalk line, singed and burned too many times. I've been a hoodwinker. I'm in bamboozled. I've been left for dead. I'm in plagued by refusals. I'm in a hoodwinker. I'm in bamboozled.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.